This is Greg Waters, and I'm here with Jessica Martucci. It is June 22nd, 2017, and we're speaking today with Dr. Rory Cooper at the, the Human Engineering Research Laboratories here in Pittsburgh, where he serves as founding director. Thank you for taking the time to meet with us.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be interviewed.
I should also say that this interview is being conducted as part of the Scientists with Disabilities Project at the Chemical Heritage Foundation. So let's start at the very beginning. Where were you born?
I was born in East L.A. in California.
What year? What's your birthday?
I was born in 1959.
Okay. How was East L.A. in 1959?
We didn't live there for long. We stayed there, I think we were about 5 years old when we moved out of East L.A. Mm-hmm. And moved to Riverside, California.
Okay.
And lived there for about 5 years, and then we moved to San Luis Obispo, California. Mm. And I finished up grammar school, and then went to middle school and high school in San Luis Obispo. So I consider that kind of my hometown.
Could you talk about your parents? What were their names?
My father's Alan Cooper. My mother's Alice Cooper, not the musician. My mother was an automobile mechanic. My father actually was a model maker, which is a type of machinist. But then he went to, and he was also in the Army Reserve. And then he went to college, studied biology, and eventually, he went to Cal Poly Pomona, then to UC Riverside. University of California, Riverside. Mm-hmm. And then we moved to San Luis Obispo because he got a job at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo as a professor of biology and agriculture.
What were they doing originally in East L.A. when you were born?
My dad was a model maker and my mother worked in a bank.
Okay. Do you have siblings?
I do. I have a brother and a sister.
Older, younger?
Younger. I'm the oldest.
Okay.
We're all engineers.
Is that your father's influence?
He's a biologist. I think it's the influence of being the model maker and the and the mechanic. And my parents had an automotive machine shop my entire time growing up. So even when my dad was a professor, he still worked there part-time, and my mother ran the business.
So did he transition later in life to being a professor?
He did, yes.
When did he go to school? What was the process of that?
I don't think he was that old. He was in his mid-30s, I think, when he finally became a professor. But, you know, it was a family business with my grandfather. Mm-hmm. So it was Cooper and Sons Automotive.
Gotcha.
And so they maintained the business. Mm-hmm. And like I said, that was my mom's. I worked in it as a kid. That's kind of what got me introduced to introduction to engineering, because I had to learn to operate to work on cars.
Right. They put you to work early?
Yeah. I pretty much worked all my free time after school when I was about 12 years old besides doing, you know, school and track and field and cross country. Mm-hmm. But otherwise, it's a family business. You got to help out when people need help. So I learned to operate the lathe and the mill and the brake lathe and put engines in and take them out and do exhaust systems. That's probably why I kind of lean towards engineering. Especially after my engineer injury, I couldn't really, it would have been tough to do that except for manage a business like that. So engineering allowed to stay hands-on and creative, but in a different way.
How old were you when you guys moved to San Luis Obispo?
I was 10 or 11.
Okay. So you had moved around previously?
Yeah.
A couple times. All in California, though?
All in California, yeah.
Okay. Gotcha. And so what was growing up in California during that time like?
It was great. I mean, moving from Riverside to San Luis Obispo was funny because it was like 120 degrees in the summer, and in Riverside it's out in the desert, and then San Luis Obispo is on the coast, and mm-hmm. it's like 70 degrees, so... For the first few weeks, we were freezing. I remember we were the only ones wearing jackets in August in San Luis Obispo. San Luis Obispo is a great place to grow up. You know, it's a one of California's coastal towns. It's it wasn't too large. It was an interesting town because about half the population were students at either Cal Poly, San Luis Obispo, or Cuesta College, and the other half were residents. And most of them either had a business, worked for the prison, the men's colony there, or worked for Caltrans, had a center, that's California Department of Transportation, or for Pacific Gas and Electric. Mm. There's a power plant there.
Mm. Gotcha. Is that Diablo Canyon?
Well, when I was a kid, Diablo Canyon didn't open up, although my first job after becoming an engineer was at Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. But no, there was a gas-fired power plant in Morro Bay, which is just a few miles from San Luis Obispo. That was owned by PG&E, and then PG&E, I don't know if they already owned the land, but they bought or owned the land, and they built Diablo Canyon starting probably in the late 1970s, early 1980s. I think it was in the late 1970s.
So were you and your siblings close in age and also in relationship? Did you guys?
So we're all close in relationship. Mm-hmm. My sister's 2 years younger than I am, and my brother's 7 years younger than I am.
Okay. Sure.
All of us are Cal Poly graduates. My sister's an industrial engineer. My brother and I are both electrical engineers. My brother actually works for PG&E in Diablo Canyon. My sister married and moved up to the Bay Area, and she works for a company called Advanced Micro Stepper.
Nice.
The name actually is outdated now because they make machines to make microchips, and that process is entirely optical now.
So, having driven through San Luis Obispo a few times, it's a kind of not sleepy, but it's like a surf town almost.
Yeah, a little bit. It's got the famous Madonna Inn for those of you that know, like the newlywed game or the dating game.
That's close to Morro Bay, correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, a beautiful area.
Yeah.
So, did you surf at all growing up, or was that a part of your
life?
No, the
water up in San Luis Obispo is cold, right? That's 50, 60 degree water there. I mean, I tried surfing a couple of times. You have to have a wetsuit to surf up there. And surfing's kind of more, well, there's a group surfing kind of culture up by Monterey. Mm-hmm. I was a runner as a kid, and I ran track and cross country for Laguna Junior High School and San Luis Obispo Senior High School and San Luis Obispo. And for me, it was more fun to run along the beach. You know, Pismo Beach is a beautiful, long, flat beach in California. And actually, the beach between Morro Bay and Cayucas, it's about 5 miles apart, nice, beautiful beach. And just below Morro Bay, there's the dunes, or even in Napomo, that area, there's some dunes, so you can do some hill running. It's a nice area, too, because there's San Luis Obispo's kind of in the valley, and there's hills surrounding it. Mm-hmm. So it's just a beautiful countryside.
Did you spend much time in the outdoors as a kid?
I did. I was very active in the Boy Scouts. Mm-hmm. Actually became an Eagle Scout. And we had a great scout troop, Troop 319. And we would do a lot of camping in that whole area. Plus, we had Camp San Luis Obispo and Camp Hunter Liggett, the military bases. So they were very supportive of a lot of Boy Scouts to camp. And then there's the Cuesta Ridge, and there's great hiking trails there. La Ponza National Forest, Lopez Lake. So I don't think you can live in San Luis Obispo without being some kind of outdoor person.
Right.
Even when we moved back there after I got injured in the Army, we my wife and I, we love to bike and swim and do triathlons and things like that. So it's just that kind of culture. The weather's kind of ideal for being outdoors almost all year long.
You mentioned running. Is that just a natural progression from being a kid? Why did you start running?
I started actually and started in Riverside. You know, they had like some school track meets and things like that. My grandfather entered me into some of the, you know, like city little city races for kids. And then when I went to San Luis Obispo, I was always good in science, and our science teacher happened to be the track and cross country coach, and of course he pitched to the kids in science class. Most of them sort of groaned and said, "Oh yeah, I'd like to go out. I'll go out and try." Kind of unusual, I guess. Maybe not today, but that. When I was growing up, scientists were kind of the Big Bang Theory stereotype, and
so
it was a little bit unusual to like science and engineering and also like sports. So, and I liked it. So, you know, I started in junior high and did it in high school and ran in the Army and still do marathons and a hand cycle today.
Going back to like grade school, were you a good student?
I was not a great student in grade school because I had dyslexia and I was undiagnosed, and so and I had a and I have an astigmatism, so I think it was in fifth grade they did an IQ test and I scored very high, and they were like, "Well, this doesn't make any sense. How can he score high on the IQ?" And then so they actually wound up having me sent me to get my eyes checked and to a learning specialist. And they, "Oh, he needs glasses and he has a dyslexia." And,
Then
my grades turned around.
Was dyslexia recognized?
I don't know if dyslexia was a recognized diagnosis at the time, but I think it was diagnosed as a reading difficulty.
Gotcha.
So I was basically given I had a reading tutor for a couple of years. Mm-hmm. I mean, the glasses helped quite a bit. You know, if you have an astigmatism and everything's kind of fuzzy, reading is not a popular thing to do. Mm-hmm. So you wonder why you fall behind in your reading, but it's a lot harder for you, and you get a headache, pretty quickly. And then on top of that, having the dyslexia. But once I got the glasses and worked on my reading, I learned some compensatory strategies, and it got a lot better.
Could you talk about those? What kind of strategies would you use to? How did you deal with it?
Just reading more carefully, then also not just trying to read the words, but read the context, right? What does it mean?
Mm-hmm. Gotcha. And so your grades improved as you...
Yeah, after that it was fine.
You're fine. Yeah. So in high school you got...
I got good grades in middle school and high school, yeah. Yeah, my sister was a 4.0 through all middle school and high school, so it's all relative. I like to do sports and Boy Scouts and other things, and so my grades are, I think I graduated high school with like a 3.3, 3.4,
gotcha.
But I got a 4.0 in my junior, senior year,
right.
So I could do it if I applied myself. I was planning to join the Army, so.
Gotcha.
But I did all the college prep classes and for the UC system. I knew I eventually wanted to go to college, and I knew I had good enough grades to get into the UC system.
You naturally tended towards science as a kid? What is the root of that, do you think? Or is that more engineering with your background, with your family's business? And
I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know how kids, you know, you just... I liked the science class. I had some advantage because of my parents' business. Mm-hmm. My grandfathers were mechanics too, so that helped. I grew up working on things. But I think that I had good teachers in middle school and high school. It was good science teachers, and they made it fun.
Do you remember specific teachers that...
Yeah, Mike Aiello, Ron Hamley, Brian Waterbury.
One was your track teacher or your track coach?
Actually, it turned out Brian Waterbury and Ron Hamley were both track coaches. Huh. Brian Waterbury is kind of the one that recruited me and got to me. He was a long distance coach, and Ron Hamley was a hurdler and sprinter coach, but he was like our physics teacher, and Waterbury was actually a math teacher, and Mike Aiello was a biology chemistry teacher, the other thing is that they had all just gotten out of school when I was going to middle school, so the age differential wasn't that great. They were really engaged. They were trying some new things. And I liked it. And then when I moved to high school, Waterbury moved to high school. We went from the middle school to the high school. Mm-hmm. And then the other track coach at the high school was a guy named Bruce Smith, who was also a science teacher. Mm-hmm. It's a little unusual, actually, that you're a lot of times the coaches are from the physical education department or some other department, not science teachers. Maybe with track coaches, that might be a little different. But that kind of, and they were good teachers. So,
what was your specialty in track?
Long distance in high school, I think in middle school I did the half mile and the mile, and then in high school I did the mile and the 2 mile, and I ran cross country.
Gotcha. And what else were you doing other after school activities?
So I wrestled for a while as well.
How'd that go?
Good. Yeah. I'm actually was a good wrestler as well. Then I also was in the chess club, and we had a great chess team. Actually, Steve Jacoby was on our chess team. He went on to become the U.S. National Amateur Chess Champion.
Nice. Even then, he was amazing, I imagine.
He was amazing then, which was great because, you know, it's the first top four players that count in a chess team, and if you have a guaranteed win, that's not bad. Kind of said makes the little life a little easier for the rest of us.
I did want to ask, too, about your dad. At what point in your life did he become a professor?
I was in middle school.
Okay. Do you remember him? Did he ever bring his work home with him, or did he ever take you to the university? Were you exposed to that?
A little bit. My sister more so than I was. I mean, the university in San Luis Obispo was already kind of engaged. I got third place, I think, in our science fair, and it was hosted at the university.
What was your project?
I designed a motorcycle. I had a little handmade model I made of it, and all the drawings I'd done. That was another hobby of ours, was motorcycles. So.
Nice.
Building them?
Yeah, building them and riding them, yeah.
You mentioned you are an Eagle Scout.
Yeah.
What was your project?
My Eagle Scout project was to design a park. Well, was first to save the land around this lake near my home called Laguna Lake, and to have the city buy the land and create a park. Hmm. So if you look in the Telegram Tribune from those times back in the microfiches, and you'll see my name a lot fighting a guy named a developer from Los Angeles named Searchy or something like that.
And you were 18 probably at the time, around there, younger?
No, I was like 12, 13.
Oh, nice. Even younger.
Going to the planning committee meetings, and the county commission meetings, and the city council meetings, arguing that there was enough development around the lake already and that the city should buy the land. And I won. They did. They built a park, and the park is still there today.
Nice.
What year was that?
1972, 73.
Did you...
the title of my Eagle Scout project is "This Is Our Lake."
Nice.
Did you feel an affinity with the environmental movement that was sort of building around?
I did. As a matter of fact, part of my Eagle project was I created a multimedia presentation using 35 millimeter slides and movie film, and I coordinated it all with a punch tape computer so that it would have voiceover, and then slides would show, and then the movie would come, the movie clips, you know, they would stop the slides, the movie clips and sound would come. And I think that's probably, one, I think the developer just couldn't believe that I would show up to like 2 years of planning commission meetings and county commissioner meetings and all that stuff and city council meetings to voice my opinion against him. But I got the schools, so the high school, the two middle schools, and all the grammar schools to let me show this multimedia presentation, and then we showed it to the city council and the county commissioners. And
how did you acquire the skills to make that presentation? That was pretty complicated.
Yeah, it was. It was kind of interesting. When I was in seventh grade, I was what they called the assembly commissioner for our middle school, and that's so you kind of organize the school assemblies, and I was getting ready to set up for an assembly, and this guy was tearing down from this seminar workshop he was doing for the teachers on using multimedia in education. And he was from the San Luis Obispo County School District. And I was just, you know, just fascinated by the technology. And so I got his name, and I convinced my mother to take me over to see to the county schools offices to see. And they had and he had been doing these. They bought this equipment, but nobody had. He was trying to convince teachers to do it, and you know teachers are busy, and there's a pretty steep learning curve on this, and so it kind of was sitting there. And I convinced him to let me use it, to teach me how to use it, then let me use it for my Eagle Scout project.
So you're a pretty bold kid.
Yeah.
And you must have had very supportive parents, it sounds like. They took you to all these meetings, and then they took you
Actually, my parents didn't take me to the meetings. A friend of my parents did. It was a World War II vet, a guy named Charles Dills. He was a P-51 fighter pilot in World War II. And he thought it was just... He was an Eagle Scout too, and he just thought it was being a World War II vet and serving in Europe, and he thought it was a great civics lesson, right? And so, so my parents were like, "Yeah, well, if you want to go, and Charles wants to take you, have fun." I think Charles just didn't, and he up until the day he died, he was the kind of guy that would write letters to the editor and things like that, and so he. I think he just thought he. I think he had a good time, just seeing me be an environmentalist and fight the fight, and that's. And it turns out it worked. I showed my movie, and then they actually did some. Then the guy that I was working with convinced the school district that maybe we shouldn't be selling this to teachers. We should be. Talking to the students, and so they offered like an after-school program after that, and so he and I went and we taught some other kids how to use it, and then we actually, after I showed my movie to the city council and the county commissioners, they asked the middle school, and I was part of the group, to do one about our city and our county, and just kind of a promotional thing to promote the city and the county.
I'm also curious, because of your like interest in engineering and mechanical things, were you paying attention and interested in the space program that was going on when you were...
Oh, yeah, of course, yeah. I mean, that was a big motivation for me, and fearful, too, because, I mean, I watched Us Land a Man on the Moon, watched Neil Armstrong, and that I was blown away, and that, I was still in grammar school at the time, but it kind of made me want to be an engineer. On the other hand, in the 70s, NASA's space program reduced considerably, and they were laying off a lot of engineers. So your guidance counselors are like saying, oh, I don't know, you know, you gotta think about other things, or it's hard to find a job for engineers now, you know. And then it all worked out.
I know that you went to the Army immediately after high school, correct?
I did, yeah.
We'll come back to that. But briefly, was it always expected in your family that you would go to college, that you and your siblings would go to college?
It was expected of my sister. I don't think it was expected of me. I think my parents were sort of ambivalent whether I went to college or not.
Did they push you in any direction as far as what to do with life?
Just to get on my own and be independent.
Right.
So I knew I wanted to go to college, and I actually knew I wanted to study engineering, but the Army was a way to become independent, serve my country. Right? I was influenced by my uncle who served in the Army, and my dad, Charles Dills, I'd mentioned. My Boy Scout troop leader was a Vietnam veteran. Several of my high school teachers were Vietnam veterans, and some were World War II veterans. So I felt like I was important to serve.
At what point, how early in life did you realize that that was an option and that was something you wanted to do?
I think I knew when I was 12, 13 years old, right, that I was probably going to do that, and then look at what my options would be, stay on, go to college, come back as an officer. I knew I didn't want to go to college first. I wanted to see if I could see a little bit of the world, be able to have a little more, you know, get a little more mature. If I was going to join, you know, make a career of the Army as an officer, have served as enlisted first, get an idea of that was something I wanted to do. So those were...
Was there a ROTC program at your high school?
Yep.
Were you involved with that?
Nope, I was not.
Not at all? Why was that?
I liked sports and we had a family business, and I had sports, and then I had school, and I took 7 periods, so... And there's just in Boy Scouts, there's just only so many hours in the day.
Gotcha. So what was the process of signing up for the military?
That was easy. I just signed up to take the ASVAB, and that's the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery.
How did you do on it?
I did very well.
Pushed you towards engineering, or was it?
I could do anything once I score on the ASVAB. So, of course, when you do that, the recruiters start calling. I mean, you take the ASVAB at all, they start calling. You take the ASVAB and score in the upper 10%, they call all the time.
Right. So what were those conversations like? They were just pulling you in different directions as far as options that you had?
So it was really a tussle between the Marine Corps and the Army.
Right.
I was kind of time limited because it was in 1976. If you joined in 1976, you'd get the GI Bill from the Vietnam era. Joined after 1976, you get the Montgomery GI Bill. It wasn't nearly as good.
Gotcha.
Really, for me, the hemming and hawing was a little bit more between Army and Marine Corps. And the other hemming and hawing was, where could I go? Choice of assignment, choice of MOS, military occupational specialty. So there was a little bit,
a
few months of negotiating back and forth.
Did you have family members and those other veterans that you had mentioned in your life? Were they pushing you in any direction?
No, not really.
So mostly
to them it was just more about, you know, yeah, it's a good thing. You're a young man. You should go give some time to your country. Well, you got to figure out what you want to do.
So what did you decide on as far as your role in the military?
Well, so I... unfortunately, you know, I joined it. I took the ASVAB like in October or September, and that's not really a good time to take the ASVAB because, the jobs start to fill up over the course of they go on a calendar year. So the types of jobs, I was trying to get something in electronics. And I also didn't want to enlist for 4, 5, or 6 years. So the Marine Corps basically said, well, you just join the Marine Corps. We'll tell you where to go. We'll tell you what to do. you know, your scores are really good, you'll likely get what you want, but, and then I said, all right, so I'll go to the Army. The Army said, well, yeah, we can, here's a list of things, and you qualify for everything, but I need people in these things, and they can offer your duty station. So I offered for Europe. I said, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to go and see something, and mm-hmm. that kind of restricted my MOSs. So I wound up being in what they call a unit armorer, which is the basically the person that repairs the weapons.
Gotcha.
Which kind of was pretty easy for me because I had the background and the mechanical background right. and aptitude.
So weapons being small arms and...
Yep, like the pistols and machine guns and hand grenades and those things.
Gotcha. What kind of specialized training was that? So you had basic training and then you had to go...
Yeah, this is in the logic of the Army. I was enlisted in California. I could have gone to Fort Ord for basic training, but no, the Army sent me to Fort Dix, New Jersey, 40 years ago this week.
Nice. And what was that time like? I mean, I imagine it was very exciting. And
yeah, well, you know, they put you on a pair of yellow footprints like those on the floor over there. Which a friend of mine gave me to remind me, although if you notice those are Marine Corps yellow footprints, he was a Marine colonel, to remind me that I went astray. And people start yelling at you, right? Mm-hmm. And you're sleep deprived, they cut all your hair off, take all your clothes away, take all your money away, and give you new clothes and
sounds like a good time.
And a whole new name.
Mm-hmm.
So... kind of makes you wonder what you got yourself into, and you're pretty far away from home, right? And you know, you kind of learn to go with the flow. After a few days, it took me, you know, after you kind of get over the initial shock and the sleep deprivation, you realize that lots of people have gone through this before. It's a process.
You're not special.
Yeah. And then you also sort of realize that you just do what you're told.
Yeah.
You don't quest, you just do what you're told, right? And I was in great shape, so that wasn't an issue for me. And
prior to joining the Army, had you spent time away from home at all?
Yeah, I'd spent some summers with my grandparents, and we'd vacation with my grandparents, so... And in Boy Scout camps, I didn't really have any real separation anxiety from my parents, which that's a hard, you know, that for some people is a hard thing. And of course, you know, when I was in, there was no Skype or email or texting. You couldn't even call home. You basically could write letters. I'd write a letter once a week or so.
And what was your family's reaction to you wanting to join the military? They were all for it?
Fine.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Was there any concern? I mean, Vietnam had just ended, correct?
Yeah.
Was there some concern there that perhaps, well, that the war was over, but there was, I mean, joining the military is always
hazardous. I mean, they never expressed it to me. I mean, there was a lot of hostility towards the military at that time.
Yeah.
I think my parents were, you got to do something with your life. This is a good thing to get started.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, they never pressured me one way or the other. It was good for me. The military has still been good to me.
Yeah. So you would go to basic training. How long does basic training last?
Mine was about 10 weeks.
Okay. Does that include specialized training for your job? That's extra?
Well, I was just did basic infantry training.
Gotcha. And where'd you go after that?
Fort Jackson, South Carolina.
Gotcha. What were you doing there?
That was my first exposure to the New Jersey, and first exposure to South Carolina, which also, it was the first time I saw Washington, D.C., because The Army is an interesting organization. You know, I was 17 years of age. I couldn't even go to Europe yet because you had to been 18 because Europe was a forward deployment because of the Cold War and the 10 divisions of Russians sitting on the border. So they gave me a plane. They gave me a train ticket, dropped me off at the train station, and said. You're going to go to D.C., you got to lay over there, and then you got to get on another train, you got to go to Charlotte, Jacksonville, South Carolina,
okay.
I think it is, or Charlottesville, I'm not sure exactly. right outside Fort Jackson. And so actually we had a layover, so in my Army uniform, went walking around, saw the Washington Monument, some of the stuff on the Mall, got back on the train. Mm-hmm. Kind of interesting that they have the faith that you have the the wherewithal to actually get where they want you to go.
Had you gone, you were with a group on this trip?
Yeah, technically, so right? They gave us a bunch of plane, you know, all of us train tickets, and
right.
Some people were going to, like, you know, Fort Bragg, North Carolina, and Fort Lee, Virginia. And
so were there people that you went through basic with that were doing the same thing you were, that were going to go get the same?
Oddly enough, no.
Just you?
I actually joined on the buddy system with a guy named Matt Moore, and he wound up going to Fort Lee, Virginia, and I wound up going to go to Fort Jackson. You're supposed to go through the Army together, so much for that. Even when we got to basic training, I was in one battalion, he was in another, so we might see each other on the parade field walking by, and that was about it. So that's kind of went with, you know, go with it. And Fort Jackson's where I learned how to do the small weapons repair.
Gotcha. And how long was that training?
That was about 8 weeks.
Gotcha. And you stayed there after the 8 weeks, or were you deployed elsewhere?
So I was supposed to go to jump school, and then that kind of fell through. And then I was supposed to go to Fort Polk, Louisiana. And that's when I went to talk to my company commander and said, no, well, you know, sir, when I signed up, I said, I waived my, you know, I chose this MOS so that I could go to Europe, and now you're sending me to Fort Polk, Louisiana, and I think we have a deal here. And it got a little odd discussion about the questioning the wisdom of the Army. I kind of said, well, you know, a deal's a deal, right? And most people didn't want to go overseas, so I said, you should be happy that I'm volunteering to go overseas. So I had to hang around for a little while, and then he said, well, you can't go overseas, you're not 18. So I said, well, then why don't you send me to jump school? And then he said, all right, I'll put you in for jump school. And then he came back and said, your recruiter called and said he'd like you to come back home, and then I do a hometown recruiter program, so we're going to send you back to California for until you turn 18 to work as a hometown recruiter.
Was that common? They would send people back home to?
If you were smart and a good kid, yeah, they'd send you back home. I mean, usually one in the recruiting office that was a hometown recruiter.
Gotcha.
Yeah, the idea was that there'd be somebody in the office that had just graduated from high school, might even know you, right? I mean, I graduated in June, and I was back there like in October, mid-September, October. And so, of course, I knew a lot of the kids in the high school, and a lot of the kids in a lot of the freshmen at the community college who had been at the high school, and so. You know, went to him to like school assemblies and then worked in the office.
But you had in no way expected that that would have been your job.
No, I knew that was a temporary job.
Okay, how long did that last?
Until I turned 18.
And then you?
Then they got my orders. You're going to Germany. I turned 18 in November, and they sent me to Germany.
Where did you serve in Germany?
Well, first I went to play what they call a repo depot, replacement depot. It was an old prison in Frankfurt, and then I was there for a few days. And then the same thing, they gave me a train ticket and said you're going to go to Worms. And they said, "Oh, well, because I was an Eagle Scout and I'd done the hometown recruiting, I got promoted, so I was one rank above most of the people in the repo depot." And so they said, you have to drop these people off at these bases, and you're the last guy on the line. And so that's the thing about the Army. You know, you're the highest ranking person. You're in charge, even though you're like only one step up from the bottom rung. You know, you are in charge of the guys on the bottom rung. So it's okay. So I dropped those guys off. I got to Worms, Germany. Martin Luther's trial was held there, the Diet of Worms. And I got there, and there's nobody there. Every other base, every other train station, there was somebody there. Picked the guy up. I handed him over, gave them their orders. They signed off. I went on to the next, took the next guy. I get to mine. There's nobody there. And I don't speak German. And I go to somebody in the train station. I said, where's the army base? And they just said, out the door, to the first street, make a left, and keep walking. And I had my... my duffel bag and my overseas bag, and I hoped it wasn't 20 miles away. Turned out it was a couple miles down the road. And I got there, I was on the back side of the base, but I didn't know how big the base was either, so I just climbed the fence. threw my bags over the fence, climbed the fence.
Were they supposed to send someone for you?
They were. But
so it goes.
Communications weren't great at the time, and there was no way to like call or anything. So, just found the MPs, showed them where I am. This is my orders. This is where I'm supposed to go. They're like, oh, that's three buildings over on the left. Go knock on the door. And by that time, it was like 11 o'clock on a Friday night or something like that, and. So, went in. That too. All right, we've been expecting you. So that's nice. How come nobody was there to meet me? I don't know. I think they were expecting me the next day. Somehow they got the orders for.
Gotcha.
I showed up a day earlier than they were told I was going to be there. It's fine.
What was your assignment on base there in Germany? I guess the larger question is, how large was the military presence in Germany at the time, and what was the mission, what was going on at the time?
About 500,000 people at the time. It was the Cold War. Our mission was to deter the Russians from attacking Western Europe, basically, right? So that's what I was assigned to a unit called 3rd Ordnance Battalion, 59th Ordnance Brigade, 32nd Air Defense Artillery Command, which we, our unit actually was... oversaw Pershing missiles, the short range or medium range nuclear missiles in Europe.
And what was.
My job was to make sure that all their machine guns and stuff were in good working order if anything bad happened.
Gotcha. What was life like on base or off base in Germany?
So it turns out that the base I was on, I could have walked around to the other side. It was about a mile, square mile of. Space that was not very big at all. About 1,500 of us were on the base, and there were two types of soldiers there. There were the barracks rats that basically just lived on base and complained about how miserable it was that they were in Germany, and there were all those of us that walked out the gate to see what was on the other side. And so I was one that.
How often did you guys go off base?
My friends and I, we went off base. Several times a week, most weekends, every chance we got. As a runner, I'd go off base every single day to run. I mean, it was pretty boring running around the one road the one perimeter road around our base. Even to go to the gym was off post. So I was off post all the time.
How large was the town where the base was located?
Worms was about 50,000 people at that time. It's about 70,000 now.
Gotcha.
I took the German classes and learned German, and I actually married a German girl. We've been married for 35 years.
You guys met there?
Yep.
Nice. How did you meet her?
A German-American friendship dance.
Nice. Was that
her sister introduced us.
Did she speak English?
Nope.
You spoke enough German?
Yep.
Gotcha. How was learning German? Is that...
Actually, it's difficult to get started, but it's... because it's very rule-based and very strict. On the other hand, English is a Germanic language, so once you understand German, you understand English better. Mm. But English is a very forgiving language. And especially Americans, we kind of let you could throw a bunch of words out there, and most people will sort of figure out the meaning and let you get by. Germans are got to be done properly. But I learned pretty well. And I was lucky that, because a lot of times... It back in the late 70s, early 80s, you could still speak German, and the Germans would speak German back to you. Our nieces and nephews I mean, they speak German to me because I speak German fluently. We speak German at home, but if our American friends come over, they just they speak English to them right away. Because they have English in school starting in like the fourth grade, and they watch German. They watch American TV. They're on the American internet. They don't even have an accent.
So you met your wife how long before you guys got married after you met?
3 years.
Gotcha. So you guys dated for, you were there the entire time, or were you?
No, I got injured in part of that time, got sent home, so that kind of messed up our courtship for a while.
How long were you in Germany before you got injured?
I was in Germany for 3 years before I got injured, but I, almost 3 years, and then we had been dating for a year when I got injured.
Okay. You want to take a break?
Yeah.
All right. So we were discussing your time on base in Germany. Did your job change at all the entire time you were there?
Yep. So I came up, I was there about a year, and the Army started a program to help build German-American relations. It was part of the anti-terrorism activities in Europe. So at the time there was a lot of terrorism, Bader-Meinhof, Red Army Faction, Red Army Brigade, basically Russian and East German sponsored terrorism in Western Europe. Actually turned out to be bigger than we actually thought it was at the time. After the wall came down, they were able to go through the records of the Stasi and the East German government. They found out there were many more spies than we had thought there were, and many more things that the Russians and East Germans were responsible for than they were getting credit for at the time. So I guess it's like now with the Russian hacking stuff, right? They, as they dig into it more, they realize that a lot more stuff has been, they've been doing it longer and more than we thought than they thought they were. So so they changed me to what's called civil affairs, which is military to military, military to civilian relationships.
Okay. So what kind of work, what was your day-to-day like doing that job?
My day-to-day was cool. They took me out of uniform, put me in civilian clothes. They taught me German fluently. They sent me to an immersion school. They taught me about German culture and heritage. Talked me about conflict resolution, group dynamics, individual dynamics, and they taught me, and so they, I got to do all kinds of things: German-American festivals, German-American joint training, working with the German police, going with our commanding general to various events, translating.
And I imagine you got to travel throughout Germany doing
this? I did. It was awesome.
Nice. That was a new position, you said?
That was a new position, yeah.
Was that created not for you necessarily, or?
No, it was a new program, and I was selected to be part of that program.
Okay. So at what point did you meet your wife?
Through that program, basically, the German-American friendship dances, one of the things we organized. Her sister had been coming to some of the activities that we had organized, and she brought my wife, and she introduced us. We met and started dating.
What year was that?
1979, July of
79. And how common was that for American military personnel to?
It's not uncommon, but it's not that common. I mean, I was going to be over there for 3 years at 18 years of age.
True.
So, and there were two women on our post. So, it was either a long period of abstinence or go outside the gate and see that half the population out there is women. In here, it's 1,498 to 2. So, I told you I was a fairly smart guy. I could figure out the odds were a little better on that side of the fence than on this side of the fence.
And at the time, was that your first time to Europe?
That was, yep.
And so you were a young kid.
I was.
Exposed to a whole new world.
I was.
What was that like?
That was awesome, actually. I think it's shaped my whole life, really. That you could see that people, different government, different language, different culture, and it works, right? They have families and go to work and go to school and have lives, and you start to say, oh, well, you know what? There's different ways of thinking, different ways of doing things, and it works out. Mm-hmm. Right?
Did you get to travel throughout Europe?
I did. Since I was a good runner, mm-hmm. I got on the Army, U.S. Army Europe track and cross-country teams. So I got to go to Spain, Italy, France, Austria, Switzerland, Belgium, Netherlands, the U.K. It's pretty awesome, all over Germany.
And those were competitions? Were they...
Yeah, different competitions. Yep.
Were they friendly competitions amongst military personnel, or was that?
Yeah, there were military to military competitions,
okay.
And then we also ours military divisions and civilian competitions, a little bit of both.
That's cool. I didn't know they did that sort of thing.
They still do. Yeah. Actually, it's called a program called CISM. I don't know what it stands for, but it's like Congress International Sports. Something like that. It's a French name that's been sort of converted to English. And that's what it does. It prevents military cooperation through sport.
Nice.
So I got to participate in some of their activities.
It was in 1980 that you had your accident?
Yep, July 23rd, 1980.
You want to talk about that?
I had some knee injuries, and so... I was doing, you know, in the Army you had to do what they call PT, physical training.
Yeah.
So I was, instead of running, I was bicycling. Mm-hmm. And that day, I had picked up my bicycle from the shop. I think I had to get a new rear wheel. Mm-hmm. And I went to have lunch with my wife at her parents' house. And I was going to ride my bike with her to work. She was studying hotel and restaurant management, or doing an apprenticeship in hotel and restaurant management at a hotel about 15 kilometers away. And but I got delayed because I was having some trouble with my bike and I was trying to get it running. So her brother was on a moped. Mm-hmm. So we started off afterwards after her. And we came into this city called Frankenthal, where the hotel was. And I was going down the bike lane. There was one of these cutout bus lanes, bus stops. And there was a bus letting off passengers. And he didn't clear his left. He didn't see that I was on the left-hand side. So he pushed me basically right into the oncoming traffic. Mm. And unfortunately, there was a... German Mercedes semi-truck coming in the oncoming traffic, oncoming lane, so it hit me head-on. Hmm. And basically I hit the left front side of the vehicle, bounced on the ground, the front wheel rolled over my chest, and caused me a spinal cord injury plus a lot of broken bones and internal damage. And I laid on the street, and I thought, oh, shit, I can't walk. And kind of passed out. Then an ambulance came. I remember I was in the ambulance, and the ambulance driver kept asking me, treiben Sie viel Sport, which means, do you exercise a lot? Do you do a lot of sports? And I said, I managed to nod and say yes, and then he was looking to see why my blood pressure and heart rate were so low. And then he took me to the ambulance took me to a local hospital, they actually thought I was dead. I wasn't going to make it. But they had a doctor come by to check, right, to certify, and I grabbed his hand and looked at him, and a doctor called for a trauma helicopter and had me evacuated to the Ulgersheim Unfallklinik, which was created to support BASF. They have a big, large BASF factory and chemical plant there. And they needed a trauma center for a level one trauma center for if they had burns or fires or explosions. So they flew me via a Life Flight helicopter to the trauma center. And a young Dr. Ungemach, he met me there, and he spent probably the next week to 10 days at my bedside taking care of the internal bleeding and trying to stabilize me.
So what was the most serious of your injuries? It was the...
Oh, the bleeding, internal bleeding. Yeah. I collapsed my lungs and then a number of other bleeding organs.
And so, broken bones as well, you said?
Yeah, well, the spinal cord injury is the most severely lasting injury, but that wasn't life-threatening at the time. Mm. And once you got the infections, but I was in intensive care for about 6 weeks. And then the Army sent a Life Flight helicopter to evacuate me to a Frankfurt Army hospital.
Okay.
Do you have any lasting organ damage from all of that?
I've recovered pretty well, actually. So I didn't lose any organs. So normally you might lose a spleen or something like that, but I didn't lose any organs.
And so you spent the first 6 weeks, you said, in a local hospital? And then you were sent to an Army hospital?
Yep.
Okay, and at what point rehab comes into play?
So I spent some time in the Army hospital. You have to get stabilized enough to get a medevac flight out, and they have to work out what they're going to do. You know, where are they going to fly you to? What are they going to do with you? Mm-hmm. And they put me on a... So the Air Force flew me on a medevac flight out of Frankfurt. That's kind of interesting. There were two of us with spinal cord injury on the plane, one female soldier and myself. She had had a motorcycle accident. Mm-hmm. And they were, we asked that if we could look at each other half the time and look away from each other, we're in what's called a striker frame. Mm-hmm. Striker frame is basically you're sandwiched between two cots, and you have like a hole cut out for your face. And then, and those cots are on a rotate on the end like a barbecue spit, so they can flip you down, flip you up, and that's to keep you from getting pressure ulcers. They have you on your face, have you on your back, have you on your face. So we said, all right, can we be half, you know, at least talk to each other part of the flight? No, you can't fraternize. You have to be looking away from each other. And then we finally said, oh, okay, I went fraternize. We can just blink at each other, basically. And so they said, all right. And then what they induce you to a medically induced coma. Mm. And so it didn't matter. The whole argument was for naught. They could have just said, we're going to knock you out anyways. It doesn't matter. And I never saw her again. But then we landed in Andrews Air Force Base, and then they put us on a beautiful Bluebird bus, like the old school buses, painted like a sky blue, and drove us to Walter Reed. I stayed there for a few days. Now, my parents had, when I was in intensive care, without my knowing, they had me. They had convinced the Army to send me to a civilian hospital near home. So I stayed at Walter Reed for a while. And then the Air Force medevaced me to Vandenberg Air Force Base, and then I took an ambulance to San Luis Obispo. And I was there. I had to have a few more surgeries. Mm-hmm. Got registered with the VA in Santa Barbara, and then I went to, then of course they have these nurses come and tell you about where you want to go to rehab. I'd had heard bad stories about the VA, and so I opted to go to Santa Barbara rehab, which I wasn't very satisfied with. I tried to escape on the first day. So finally the doctor sat down with me and we had talked about what do we need to do to get out of here. And so he said, you got to be able to, you know, get in and out of your wheelchair, you got to be able to do a wheelie, you got to be able to hop a curb, you got to be able to drive a car, you have to be able to walk on long leg braces. We got to be able to cook a meal, you got to be able to brush your own teeth, go to the bathroom, take a shower, all that stuff, get in and out of bed, get dressed. So we kind of came up with this checklist, and 3 weeks later, I was able to do all those things. I said, I'm leaving. I want to go home.
What was the extent of your paralysis?
I'm a T78, so it's basically belly button down. So so I went back to my parents for a while and started college. I got out in November of 1980, and I was started at Cal Poly in January of 1980.
What about your not yet wife?
So she was still in Germany. She finished up school. She came to visit in the summer of 1981. We did a vacation with my grandparents in their motorhome. Kind of saw my grandmother in Michigan. So the cross-country trip, and then came back. Decided we were still in love, and got engaged. Then I had to do all the paperwork to get her a green card. And, well, I get a green card to get permission to get married. So we, you know, it's called a fiancé visa. Fortunately, since I was in the Army when I got injured, and we met when I was in the Army, I was able to get her under the War Bride Act of 1948, as long as I could get command approval to marry her. So we went through that paperwork, and I think we filled out that paperwork in like August of 1981, and we got approval in May of 1982. So she came over and we got married. First by the Justice of the Peace, and then we had a church wedding a month later.
I did want to ask about your emotional state following the accident, and also the military. Do they offer, I'm sure they do, some form of counseling or help the transition?
At that time, they did not. Now they do it's 1,000 times better than when I went through it. Now, I was lucky. My friends in the military, actually, some of my close friends, they came to the wedding. Some of them were still friends today. And my military unit, you know, it kind of that time was sort of left up to your individual unit. You know, now the VA is much more proactive. Mm-hmm. And, well, I didn't even finish. I was not happy with the civilian rehab, so I actually checked myself into the Sepulveda VA. Mm-hmm. And went through VA rehab.
Why were you dissatisfied with the VA or with the civilian rehab?
Well, because I started meeting veterans, and they're like, oh, this is what you get from the VA, and this is what they taught us to do, and here's how you use escalators, and here's how you can go downstairs, and oh, they have sports programs, and I wasn't exposed to any of that. So I went to the Sepulveda VA spinal cord injury rehab, and they taught me to swim, and opened up a lot of other doors for me, helped me get into wheelchair racing.
So was there any form of counseling as far as emotional?
Yeah, there was emotional. I had a social worker. Yeah. Still have a social worker to this day. It's kind of a mandatory thing. I still get my care in the VA. And you know, so they have a social worker that touches base with you. And
so was that very hard, extremely hard for you being an athlete? Was that transition?
It was. The transition was hard. There are a couple things that really helped out. My grandparents were extremely supportive, and they were like fully engaged in whatever I needed. And my girlfriend still loved me and wanted to marry me. And I had a goal to go to school, and I was able to go to school, and you know that was a big plus. And I had some great veteran mentors Tim Davis, the guy up in the picture there, was my peer mentor. He was injured in the Tet Offensive, a Marine. And so, you know, he was able to kind of, he's a few years ahead of me, so tell me what life was like and make some of those adjustments. Mm. There's, you know, you go through the whole why me and depression, but what really helps is, you know, when you got things to do every morning and you got to study and you have friends and people that can help you out. And,
So when you first came back, you were living with your parents?
Yep.
How long did you live there with them?
Year and a half.
Okay. Gotcha. And did you, when, at what point did you get married? That was...
May of 1982.
Okay. Well, while you were still with your parents, or was that...
No, we moved. I got an apartment.
Gotcha. Okay. And...
when you moved back to your parents' house, did you, were there any, like, modifications to the home that needed to be made?
There were, but my parents didn't make them.
Okay.
I said, the world's not friendly towards people with disabilities. You should figure out how to make it work. Which actually helped a little bit when we had to rent apartments and houses and things like that. You really couldn't make any real modifications. So, and then remember, there's no ADA, right? So traveling, I couldn't rent a car. There were no accessible hotel rooms. So at that time, you really had to learn to fight for yourself. So there, you know, I wound up crawling on the floor a lot. And I mean, that's where sports helped. You were have a, you know, be flexible and strong, and helps to be young.
How old were you when you had your accident?
20.
Wow. Gotcha. So the transition back to living in California, did you know prior you had planned to go to school? Did that accelerate going back to school?
Your injury? Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Gotcha.
My choice.
You had planned, what was the plan to stay in the military? How much
longer? No, I was actually planning to go to school. I actually wound up going to school exactly when I planned to go to school.
Okay.
I was supposed to get out in June, and I'd extended my enlistment for 3 months because my replacement backed out.
Mm.
So they needed somebody to kind of fill the gap. So I said, all right, I'll, they asked me if I would stay on longer, so I extended my enlistment. And I thought about going to school in Europe or staying in the United States. I didn't get accepted to the program. Well, I had not been accepted to the program by the time I got injured, and so it was kind of a moot point at that point.
Gotcha.
But I'd been accepted to Cal Poly, so.
Was that where your dad taught? Where did your dad
teach? He taught biology there.
Gotcha.
I was in the School of Engineering, so.
Gotcha. So you did your Bachelor's of Science in Electrical Engineering.
Yep.
Was it... you had already decided right when you entered that that was where you wanted to focus on, or is it?
Actually, I enrolled as a dual major in mechanical and electrical engineering. I was kind of waffling which one I was going to do. And I took courses in both for the first 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Then I started to realize that they're actually pretty similar.
Mm.
And I stuck with electrical because I thought it would have more of a future.
Yeah.
I don't think it could have been a flip of a coin. It could either way. I mean, there's still plenty of jobs for mechanical engineers and
right.
plenty of jobs for electrical engineers. And
how?
I do both today, so it worked out either way for me.
How is the university as far as accessibility?
So physically, they were not very accessible, but I will tell you from a social perspective, they were awesome.
Hmm.
Better than Pitt today.
How so?
Well, when I first enrolled, my advisor said, oh, you're the first student we've had in a wheelchair in engineering. We're going to have to get the faculty together and decide how to modify the curriculum, and we'll see. And I said, oh, you know what? I'd rather not. Let's, if you do that, then I don't think I'll be able to get a job because I won't have the same degree as everybody else. I won't really be an engineer. And his name was Saul Goldberg. We're still friends, and Saul was like, kind of frown, and then he goes, you know, you're right. This is really just an engineering problem. We should just figure out how to make it possible for you to do everything that everybody else does. So he would rally the faculty and say, all right, Rory's going to be taking this next semester. Let's figure out how to make it happen. You know, they might have to go in between semesters and lower equipment to a table, or they even, you know, wound up building some special lab benches that I could work at, or I built a standing chair so I could get on the lathe in the mill, and you know, between them and me, and of course, the further I got along, the more I could participate in the process. And anyways, I get in there early and then say, I don't know, I'm not really stable here. We kind of work it out, and I'd go. I was really lucky early on. The first couple of years, a lot of my lab partners were veterans, so we got along real well together. The problem is they had a lot of buildings that still had like stairs to get to the labs and things like that. But I made a deal with the ROTC commander that I would help with their students with some tutoring. Because I was much better in college than I was in high school. I think I had like a 3.7, 3.8 GPA when I graduated from Cal Poly. So I would tutor for them, and they would carry me up the stairs.
Nice.
And then I could also teach them a little bit what it was like to be a non-commissioned officer and what officers have to do.
So you were involved in ROTC in that?
Yeah, as an informal way.
Gotcha.
So that was cool. Saul helped me get into the PhD program too. So,
At what point did grad school become an option?
I didn't even think about it until I got my bachelor's degree and I started looking for jobs. Mm-hmm. What happened was most of the jobs I was really interested in, they were like, you know, you're a really sharp guy. You got to go get a graduate degree and you'll have a much better, you'll do better, right? Because I interviewed with Disney, I interviewed with NASA, I interviewed with PG&E, I interviewed with a couple of defense contractors and NASA suppliers and... Mm-hmm. Most of them said, you know, we're happy to hire you. We can make this work. Not all of them, but a couple of them. I decided to take the job at PG&E, be closer to home. Mm-hmm. My wife could keep her job. By that time, she was working in Wells Fargo Bank. Mm-hmm. And she was going to school at Cuesta College part-time. So I thought I'll get a master's degree at Cal Poly. But I finished my project at PG&E pretty quickly, and it didn't seem to be a lot of upward mobility. And I also got exposed to teaching there. I got to teach some of the apprentices, and I kind of like teaching. So I thought, Saul Goldberg and Bill Horton, who was his office mate, they were like, maybe get you on for your PhD and see what you can, you know, maybe get a teaching job or go to NASA or something like that as a researcher. So I did. So applied to UC Santa Barbara.
Was the curriculum much different? I'm not familiar with electrical engineering programs from your bachelor's work to your master's work, or is it just same more intense?
From bachelor's to master's, it's just more intense, and mm-hmm. I got more into digital control and more on the control system side. My master's thesis was to design an enunciator, which is an alarm system for Diablo Canyon Nuclear Power Plant. Oh. So it was like a trend analysis system, sensing and trend analysis.
Interesting. So the PhD became an option at some point as a master's student?
Yep.
It just became a natural transition. So you decided to... Did Cal Poly have a
PhD
program?
They didn't offer a PhD.
Okay.
Or they didn't at the time.
So you had to go somewhere else.
Yep.
Gotcha. Did you apply far and wide? Or
nope. Just? I applied to Caltech and UC Santa Barbara.
Gotcha.
And... We chose UC Santa Barbara because it was 2 hours away. My wife could keep her job. By that time, while I was working at PG&E, we had bought a trailer, believe it or not, we lived in a mobile home. So we were trailer trash for
nice
3.5 years, single wide with a pop-out.
And that was accessible fine? You guys modified it?
We made it accessible because we could own it. That was kind of nice because that was the first time we had something that was accessible. And we had no roommates or nobody kicking us out because of the California's growing housing market. And it was in a rent-controlled trailer park because trailer parks in California are under rent control.
Huh.
So we knew what our expenses were roughly going to be.
I did want to ask about your wife's transition to living in the States. Was that always an she knew, dating you obviously, that that was a potential outcome?
Yeah, she thought we might go to the United States or then come back to Germany. Mm-hmm. And she wasn't really looking to stay in the United States. You know, but she did well because she'd studied hotel and restaurant management. Yeah. You know, that, and she worked for, after she graduated, she worked for a Ramada hotel in Germany for a while. So all the systems were exactly the same as in the United States. Mm. She got a job at Howard Johnson's within a few weeks of coming to California.
Hmm. What kind of work was she doing?
She was wound up being the front office manager. Because, you know, most of the people that work in those hotels, except for the manager, are students or kind of transient jobs, at least at the time. So somebody who actually had trained in that
in high demand.
was unusual. And if they were, they would normally go to the big cities, right? Not San Luis Obispo.
True.
And even in San Luis Obispo, not Howard Johnson's. It just so happened that Howard Johnson's had the job open. And the manager there, Ed Wilcox, it was really nice and got mm-hmm. along. And the two of them really did a great job running that mm-hmm. Howard Johnson's.
Gotcha.
So hotel and restaurant there. Then she started going to school part-time at the community college. And eventually she left that there to get a job at Wells Fargo Bank and was a business teller or sold business products to business small businesses, or banking products to small businesses. And she liked that because at Howard Johnson's, even though her boss was great, the pay wasn't that great. You got a better salary and benefits at the bank. But also, hotels, you don't actually meet anybody from the city. Everybody's from somewhere else, just
true.
Transient. And she thought the job at the bank she'd get to meet the locals and get more connected to the community. So she did. She met my former girlfriends, they're her parents, people I went to high school with. It was a little dangerous for a while there. At Howard Johnson, she was isolated, and when she went to work for the bank, she got to know my entire life history from other people's perspective. Because there weren't many banks in the city, so it was a good chance that... And it was like, Cooper, oh, hi. And you have an accent. How did you wind up in San Luis Obispo? And then she'd tell them, oh, I know Rory, and I know Tammy. So she'd come home at night with these, oh, so you didn't tell me about this. Or, oh, you said, I, you know, that's not really fair. I should get like a job at a bank in your hometown and hear what they have to say. It's kind of like,
when you were applying for PhD programs, both at, you did UC Santa Barbara and
yes.
What was the other one?
Caltech.
Gotcha. Did your disability come up at all in the application process?
Yes.
How'd that
Not work? In the application. So so the nice thing I mentioned, Bill Horton, mm-hmm. he was doing a sabbatical at UC Santa Barbara, and he called me up and he said, Rory, you're going to get rejected because they think your grades are inflated out of sympathy for your disability and being a veteran. And they're not going to let you in the PhD program. So you need to call down here immediately and ask for an appointment with the department chair and the admissions committee before they send you the rejection letter. So I called down. I said, I'll be in your area. I'd like to come by if I can and meet with you and some of the faculty. I'm really interested in, you know, coming here for my PhD. And fortunately, Bill had kind of, you know, said, oh, you should really meet this guy. He's different than you're thinking. He's very athletic. He's very independent. And they agreed. So I did. I went down there. I met with them. I spent the day. They said, oh, well, this is very good. We're going to meet again. And a couple days later, they called me up and said, you're going to be admitted. Your letter will be on its way. And they gave me a teaching fellowship as well.
Okay. I did want to ask, was your master's program funded at all?
No, because I was working, right? So I did it part-time in the evenings.
Gotcha. And your PhD was, you did that full-time?
Yes.
Gotcha.
Yeah.
And you received funding for that?
Kind of. I had a teaching fellowship for the first couple years, and then the last year I got a grant to help self-fund part of my work. And then, so the last year is kind of funny. I didn't take the teaching fellowship because I was preparing for the Paralympics in 1988 in Seoul. And so they said, well, you have to choose between the teaching fellowship and continuing your PhD or going to the Paralympics. And I said, I'll finish the PhD, do the Paralympics, and turn down the, and then I guess I won't be able to get the teaching fellowship, right? So they said, well, they won't kick you out of the program, but they wouldn't offer me the teaching fellowship if I was going to be training for the Paralympics. Right. And my department chair was, he would ask me periodically, so when are you going to quit the Paralympics and finish your PhD? I said, I'm going to do them both. I'll do the Paralympics in 88, and I'll finish my PhD in 89. And I did. I went to the Paralympics in 88 and finished my PhD in 89.
I did want to ask, immediately upon coming home from Germany, did you become involved in any advocacy groups or any disability groups?
I did. I got started in wheelchair basketball. Tim Davis, my peer mentor, and I, we started a wheelchair basketball team called the Slow Motion Riders.
Nice.
And that Howard Johnson's, where my wife worked, they happened to be hosting a meeting of the California Association of the Physically Handicapped. And the president was a lady named Judy Heumann, who actually went on to later become an undersecretary for education and work for the World Bank, and under the Obama administration actually be a special assistant to Secretary Kerry in the State Department. So my wife said, hey, my husband's in a wheelchair. And they were like, well, tell them to come on down. And so I met Judy and Ed Roberts, who all of these were people that helped pass the ADA and are icons in the disability rights movement. I can actually show you a poster created for the ADA that has their pictures in it. So yeah, they got me involved in advocacy and getting curb cuts and getting the university to be accessible and about employment. And I was kind of an anomaly for them, right? Because they, you know, having a student in wheelchair studying engineering was also a little unusual, even for the disability rights movement.
Why was it uncommon for people with disabilities to be in the engineering program?
Because a lot of the engineering programs were physically not accessible. Right. Secondly, you had to, you know, use lathes and mills and things like that, which are largely inaccessible today. It's still a very hard field to break into for people with severe physical disabilities. And then your guidance counselors would sort of push you towards law, social work, counseling, political science, teaching.
So later on in your career, I'm sure you've mentored other people coming through the ranks. Do you push them toward, how do you discuss that with them?
I push them to where they want to go, but I'm a big STEM advocate. I tell them there's lots of jobs in STEM and there's plenty of room in STEM for people with disabilities.
Gotcha. Of course, we need to talk about the Paralympics. How did you become involved with that?
Well, because I was a runner, right?
And right.
I transferred to being a wheelchair racer and I was pretty fast, so won more races and go to the national championships and you win some races and they ask you to be on the national team and you go to the training camps and you set some national records and world records and you just keep moving, right?
Right.
My wife was very supportive. We spent a lot of our time together on the track with her yelling out times.
So there are varying levels of spinal injuries, obviously.
Yeah.
So the manipulation of the wheelchair depends on the injury.
Yep.
Often.
So you run in different classes.
Okay, gotcha. Mm-hmm. And the picture, what was his name?
Tim Davis.
Tim Davis. He was already involved in the Paralympics?
He never made it to the Paralympics.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. But he was involved in wheelchair sports.
So. He was a local guy there in California.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha. Did you know him before your injury? Okay. Gotcha. And so what is the process of, you have to go through tryouts?
It's actually just like the Olympics.
Yeah.
Just
you have to get invited, or do you have to just win a certain? How does that work?
You have to get invited. You have to qualify for the trials. Mm-hmm. So basically, you have to go to a regional qualifier that gets you to the nationals. The nationals you can qualify for. You have to meet the international qualifying mark, and then you get invited to be on the development team. If you're on the development team, you get a chance to travel a little bit internationally. If you do really well there, and you keep meeting the qualifying standards, and you keep being, then you get to, when the Paralympics come, you know, you get to go to the trials, right? Mm-hmm. Again, you finish in the top of the trials, you get to go.
And so you went to Korea.
I went to Korea, yeah.
What was that experience like?
Awesome.
Yeah?
I mean, I got some pictures in my office. I mean, where do you get to race in a wheelchair, especially in 1988, in front of 70,000 screaming fans, right?
Right.
It's a pretty amazing experience, right? Stay in the Olympic Village. Mm. I mean, it's just, you know, it's no different than the Olympics. It's no easier to get there either. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just as hard to get to the Paralympics as the Olympics. And now it's kind of the same experience. And I was lucky. Seoul was kind of the first one where the Olympics, Paralympics were held in the same venues. Mm-hmm. And so same place, same venues. So I still participate in the Paralympics, but as a coach for a while, now as a sports scientist.
Mm-hmm. Gotcha.
So we got to go to Brazil. And I just got my invite to go to Korea.
Nice.
What do you do as a sports scientist?
I'm one of the few engineers, and the technology plays a huge role in the Paralympics, and we want to see are people bending the rules? How's technology evolving that's going to affect the Paralympics? Are there disparities based on countries? Are there technological advantages? Is it an individual technological advantage based on sponsors, or is it a country's advantage based on the wealth of the country or its policies? So those are the things that's what I get to do.
So do you have to be, like, do you get called in to resolve, like, disputes or questions about, like, somebody's wheelchair?
That's more for the officials to handle. I usually work on educating the officials rather than getting involved in the individual disputes. And then policy for the next Paralympics, for example, right? Like saying, hey, we saw this, this, and this. We need to, is that within the rules, not within the rules? Do we need to clarify the rules? Mm-hmm. Do we need to do further research on this?
I don't know much of anything about wheelchair racing. Are all the wheelchairs standardized?
No.
It's completely, or there's parameters you have to meet?
There's parameters you have to meet. Yeah, it's more like NASCAR. more like Formula One racing, actually.
Okay. And each athlete has his own specifications.
Yep. They have to, right? It's got to fit your body like a glove.
Right.
Are the Paralympics, do they break it down by gender like they do in the Olympics? So you have the female.
Yeah, except for a few sports like boccia and quad rugby, men and women compete together. But most of them are broken down by gender, and then they're broken down by physical ability.
So that was 1988.
Mm-hmm.
And then simultaneously you're doing a PhD in electrical engineering.
Yep.
Did your studies, how did you balance those?
Work hard.
Yeah.
Have an understanding wife. And burn up a car. and then I was lucky because my PhD advisor was Stephen Horvath, and he was an engineer and physiologist, and so I was able to... My dissertation was on optimizing wheelchair racing performance, so I was able to blend the two and expanding optimization theory on the engineering side, mm-hmm. and applying it to wheelchair racing to kind of tie in my sports side.
And your resume does say you have a concentration in bioengineering.
Yep.
So, gotcha. Mm-hmm.
What is optimization
theory? What's the most efficient or least efficient way to do something?
Okay.
So the way to think about optimization theory.
And how much work has been done in this field as far as specifically to the wheelchair and the technology behind it at the late 80s? Was there a
almost
large?
None.
Okay, so there wasn't a large foundation of stuff you could rely on to.
No, it was just starting in the 1980s, mm-hmm. and so it kind of got in at the ground floor. Gotcha. from a research, engineering, and science perspective.
And so while you were doing your PhD, what are you looking forward to teaching? What was your goal once you were done with your work?
That's a really good question. I wanted a faculty position where I could do teaching and research.
Mm-hmm. And so you graduate in 89?
Yep.
And then did you start applying for jobs?
I did.
And how'd that go?
Actually, it went pretty well. I applied for some jobs, several universities, and I got interviews and offers at three, mm-hmm. four.
For faculty positions.
Mm-hmm. And one was University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and my wife basically said, I won't shovel snow outside of Germany, so I kind of had to eliminate them. Mm-hmm. Three were in California. And two were tenure stream, one was non-tenure stream. At Stanford was a non-tenure stream position, mm-hmm. Primarily research with their VA Rehab R&D Center. I turned that down because of non-tenure stream. Now retrospect, I probably could have taken it. And now I realize that big universities like Pitt and Stanford and stuff often hire people outside the tenure stream. Kind of get a look at you, see how you're going to do, and then you can compete for a tenure stream position. Mm-hmm. But I didn't know that at the time. Yeah. And so the other one was San Francisco State University and California State University, Sacramento. Mm-hmm. San Francisco State really wanted me. I would have loved going there, except the cost of living in Sacramento and San Francisco is just crazy even back then. I mean, I'd had to find a home for our trailer or something or live in San Francisco. And then Sacramento was exciting because the UC Davis Medical School campus is very close to the Sac State campus, and they offered me the opportunity to work in bioengineering. At first, they didn't have biomedical engineering at Sac State. It would have been mechanical engineering at San Francisco State. I had biomedical engineering at Sac State. And then the other thing is the Davis Medical School offered me to collaborate with them in PM&R, so I took that job.
Okay. Did your disability have any role in applying for these jobs? Or they were all aware?
Oh, yeah, they were all aware, and they were all supportive, actually.
Hmm. So you didn't feel that it had any effect one way or the other?
Not for the ones that interviewed me or offered me jobs. Okay. They were all very cool with it, and that was even pre-ADA. I think they just said, you know, you got here for the interview, you know your stuff, you've published papers, you got your PhD at Santa Barbara, mm-hmm. you knew about my athletics. I think they were all cool with it. Yeah. I mean, there was a little bit when I got to Sacramento with some of the individual faculty and other departments going like, you heard some, like one friend of mine told me when I went up for promotion, said that he had to argue with a faculty member, said, he's just a white guy in a wheelchair. I don't know what's so special about him. He goes, hey, how many people are in a wheelchair on faculty here? One? Maybe that makes him special, right? Or how about the fact that he has, you know, grants and publications and good student evaluations? That might make him special too, right? So,
well, I think that
most of the time I was accepted pretty quickly with my faculty.
Did you have to ask for any kind of accommodations when you got to Sacramento?
I did. I had to ask for a few. The good thing about California is their accessibility laws are, you know, way in advance of the rest of the country. So, you know, they already had accessible bathrooms and entrances and elevators. And, you know, we had to do some work on the lab equipment, and I got really close to the shop staff to make some of the modifications for me. And I between Santa Barbara and San Luis Obispo, I'd kind of figured that out. So the funny thing was, is though, that when the ADA was passed, the chancellor of the Cal State University system asked me to chair the committee to help make the system accommodate faculty and staff with disabilities. So the big accommodation for me was so he gave me a budget and a committee, and we kind of said, hey, what do you people would apply and say, I'm a faculty member here, and I'm blind, and I need this and this and this, and we've kind of, we could, you know, help order it for them and get set up and get the training. And the reason it was smart, because he centralized it across the entire 20-some campuses, because, you know, if it got done in San Diego, we could, you know, we got a similar request from San Luis Obispo, we kind of already had the answer rather than each person kind of exploring it. Plus, you could use the systems purchasing clout to, you know, buy more than one of one. Because what we wound up buying a lot of were laptops and LCD projection units.
Why?
Because I couldn't write on the chalkboard. But I could do it all on a laptop on Word or PowerPoint and then show the LCD projection unit, and so that was also pretty awesome, because the people with disabilities had these laptops. They were big, but you know, big laptops and these projection units before the general faculty had them, right? As a matter of fact, the original LCD projection units went on the overhead projectors. You kind of like sat it on the overhead projector and it projected through it. And then a lot of the students were like, whoa, that's really cool, because I would have images and, you know, where other faculty, you know, they bring in their yellow dog-eared notes from decades before, and rah, 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 the chalkboard, right? And I was like, hey, there's Cooper, man. He's got the state-of-the-art stuff. And then, of course, then the other faculty would go, well, why can't we get that? And then the university was smart and just said, well, yeah, we ought to be installing these in every classroom, right? And,
so in the lab, was it really just about like making benches that were lower?
Yeah.
Were there any other sort of standard modifications?
Not so much for me, right? I mean, other people need other modifications, and eventually we work on things like there's like talking oscilloscopes and, you know, talking calipers and equipment that bigger knobs and stuff for people that didn't go to hand dexterity, but. Unfortunately, I didn't need that many modifications, and so it was kind of easier to be the trailblazer in some ways, right?
It might be a good stopping point for today. Do you have any other questions? Did you want to add anything that we didn't cover up to this point in your career?
No, that's good.
Sounds good. Today is June 23rd. This is Greg Waters. I'm here with Jessica Martucci, and this is part two of our interview with Dr. Rory Cooper. Good morning.
Good morning.
I did want to go back. We finished basically yesterday at the end of your PhD program. I did want to go back and ask a couple follow-up questions about your work.
Sure.
On your resume, it says that basically right after your injury in 1980. In 1981, you began working with the Equalizer Wheelchair Company.
Yeah.
Could you talk about how you got connected with them and what kind of work you were doing?
I got connected to them in a very odd way. This guy, Craig Bash, who was working with Equalizer as a wheelchair user, he was kind of the sort of the original brainchild of the chair. I happened to just meet him at the farmer's market in San Luis Obispo on the street, and he noticed that I had built my own chair, and he was using a chair that he built, and we just kind of started talking about, and then that I was going to Cal Poly and studying engineering, and he said he was working for Equalizer with Craig Vetter. And that makes like Vetter fairings and motorcycle helmets and that. And so, and that they had that Craig had a house in San Luis Obispo, and they had a small shop where they were designing they were creating this new wheelchair, mm-hmm. basically. They asked me to come up and worked, I was a student there as a consultant on various aspects of the design. And then they also, I was involved in wheelchair racing, and they got connected to Jim Knob, who was one of the top wheelchair racers in the world at the time. And so they wanted to make a racing chair for Jim, so I kind of got engaged in that project too.
And then shortly thereafter, in 82, Cooper Engineering Company. Was that a pre-existing company, or is that when you started?
So that was a spin-off of my parents' automotive machine shop. We basically, but I started making, I gave it a try to design and sell my own sports wheelchairs, like racing chair, hand cycle, and rollers. And actually, Jim Knob actually wound up using my rollers, and Bobby Hall, who was a wheelchair manufacturer, he bought some of my rollers and distributed some of the rollers. Eventually, Quickie Wheelchairs bought me out. They never really brought any of the products to market that I was making, but they adopted them into their designs.
So were you familiar at all with wheelchair design prior to your injury?
No,
not at all. And immediately upon being in a wheelchair yourself, did you just see all kinds of problems with the current designs?
Yeah.
What were some of those?
Well, they were like 80 pounds and steel, and you know, there were three different sizes, more like a 16, 18, and 20 inches. Didn't take a lot of knowledge to be able to give people a wheelchair, and they all had kind of these Naga hide seats. Frankly, they were just bad. Fortunately, there were some people like Bobby Hall and Jim Martinson and Marilyn Hamilton in the United States, and Rainer Kuschel and Errol Markline in Europe that were starting to build their own chairs and starting to sell them. And I got started because I got out of the hospital and I had this 80-pound Invacare Rolls wheelchair, and I knew I wanted to go to college, and I started trying to push it a mile a day, and after about 6 weeks, it just basically started falling apart. And my Army unit organized a fun run, and they raised the money to buy me a Quadra wheelchair, which was also two wheelchair users, Jeff Meenebraker and Brad Parks, had kind of created that small company. It was a pretty cool chair, except for they made a lot of parts by hand, and their quality control wasn't that great. So it was a good concept, but it wasn't. And actually, that Marilyn Hamilton kind of came along and with Jim Akimoto and Dave Counts and stuff, and they started using like computer numerically controlled machining and higher qualities, you know, higher tolerances and things. Really move things along. I started out making chairs basically for myself, sort of consulting with Craig Vetter and Craig Bash, but also wanted to build a better racing chair, building the hand cycles, because triathlons were just kind of catching on. I wanted to do a triathlon, so that was kind of where I started working on that. Rollers was a way to do that's a stationary trainer. It's a way to train on your racing chair without, if it's a rainy day or too cold outside.
So like a treadmill, basically?
Yep.
Okay, gotcha. Can you talk about wheelchair racing? Basically, immediately upon being injured, you jumped into wheelchair racing.
I did. Yeah, I loved it. I was bad at first. Sort of started in the back of the pack, and my wife, who was a dancer and a gymnast, would jog along with me. But I got in better shape, and I started building better chairs, and eventually started kind of finishing in the middle of the pack, and then eventually finishing towards the front, and eventually got to the point where I could win some races. My wife still kids me to this day that. I'm a better engineer than I am an athlete, so I was able to stay one step ahead of the competition a little bit by my technological advances. That was kind of fun in the entire 1980s, is because the chairs were changing so fast that I'd come up with an innovation, or somebody else would come up with an innovation. You'd have like a 1 month advantage, and then get to a couple races, and then somebody would build upon that.
Well, I was going to say, it seems like it would be a collaborative effort to make the wheelchair better, but if you're racing, there's a competition involved. So you want to keep it secret, or do you want to...
Well, the problem is you can't really keep it secret, right? I mean, once they show up to the race, they see it, and
So there wasn't much sharing going on, though.
They were sharing. There was, we weren't really patenting things, and people were sharing. You kind of, you know, you realize it didn't take you long to figure out that after a couple of races that there was competition. People try to get faster, but there was a lot of sharing too because we were trying to make the sport itself better and make everybody faster. Mm-hmm. You know, first it was, can we get as fast as the runners, right? Yeah. And then. Then it was, after that, it was just, you know, how fast can we go and stay with... And we worked a push to change the rules. I was pretty engaged in that process.
How so?
Well, originally, racing chairs had to be four wheels. And so I did some, you know, I skirted around the rules on that a little bit by hanging like a, you know, tiny toy car wheel off the side. Or, and then they said all four wheels have to contact the ground. So, of course, you had the little tiny wheel on a piece of piano wire touching the ground. And then, so I think they eventually gave up and let us, I tried, you know, had, and then the wheelbase was limited. You could only be 120 centimeters long. That's pretty, from tip to toe, that's pretty short. And we argued that caused a lot of accidents and things, and so the wheelbase got extended. That really made a three-wheeler's practical.
Gotcha.
And allowed people to change their body position so you could lean more forward and get more power into the push rims, and that changed the sport dramatically. We clipped the push rims onto the spokes. A lot of people thought that you couldn't do that. They would break. That was actually something we did with Equalizer. We kind of were the first ones to do that. Actually, we played early on with ergonomic shapes of push rims, what was kind of the optimal shape rather than just a round tube.
Yeah.
Steering gear was another one, and that was illegal for a while. The steering gear had to be, wheels had to freely caster, but we showed that the steering gear actually made not only sport faster but safer, and risk of injury in the wrists and shoulders as well from repetitive strain injuries from always sort of pushing on with the right arm harder because of the turns on the track.
Gotcha.
Or compensating for the road crown on the road. So, but you know, that's what sport's supposed to be like, right? It involves.
Right.
I use the example of pole vaulting, right? People used to pole vault with a bamboo pole, then they pole vaulted with an aluminum pole, then fiberglass poles, and carbon fiber poles, and you know, bamboo poles, you could only go so high, one, because it didn't flex, so you had, it could only go, couldn't go higher than the pole. You couldn't actually put too much force in it or the pole would shatter. So aluminum poles stopped the poles from shattering, but they didn't flex either, so you had to, basically couldn't go higher than the pole. And then the fiberglass poles came in, and the poles not only could hold, be stronger, but they could flex. And then the carbon fiber poles were even stronger, could flex even more and give you better energy return, and people went even higher. So they changed the sport over all those times.
Were the people participating in the wheelchair racing sport primarily veterans?
So there were a lot of veterans early on, a lot of the, you know, a lot of Vietnam. So World War II veterans really started wheelchairs. I mean, World War, actually, that's not true. World War I veterans actually started wheelchair sports. You know, they started playing softball and volleyball, and the chairs were pretty bad, but they wanted to be active, and that was kind of the first concepts of using activity, both work-related activities and sports and recreation-related activities as part of rehab. And then in World War II, it really kind of ballooned. That's the Paralympic movement. It's basically a spin-off of World War II. It's hard to say who was... Wheelchair basketball also started in World War II. So the United States, Paralyzed Veterans of America, started wheelchair basketball. So every major war, Vietnam, you know, was a big... snow skiing really kind of started. There was sort of the sled skiing, polk skiing before that, but like the motto ski is an evolution out of... From the Vietnam era veterans. Wheelchair racing had started after World War II, but the demand for better chairs and moving away from the Everest and Jennings chairs and the Invacare chairs of the day towards the modern chairs that we see today, that's a result of mostly Vietnam era veterans. I mean, Marilyn is not a veteran, neither is Bobby Hall. Jim Martinson is a Vietnam Vietnam veteran. It was a little bit of both, right? But
Can I ask another follow-up? So you were making a lot of innovations in the 1980s, and you said that that's sort of like a period that a lot of other people were starting to make innovations as well with wheelchair design. What do you think it was about that decade, other than just like having Vietnam veterans around, maybe?
So there's a couple things. The Rehab Act of 1973 basically became enacted in 1977, and that started to make high schools and colleges more mainstreaming. There was sort of this sort of two parallel movements. There was a disability rights movement that started in the 1960s with the Centers for Independent Living and getting people out of institutions, and at the same time there was kind of the sports movement as well, and getting there were people wanted to be able to participate in mainstream sports, do road races, track, swimming, things like that. So they kind of went in parallel. The other thing that happened is that people, because of those two movements, people with disabilities themselves wanted to start running the sports organization. So they started challenging the technology, challenging the rules, challenging the venues. I mean, some of those early wheelchair track meets, for example, were held on around cones on parking lots rather than on real tracks. I think the other thing is the colleges and universities had to make plans in order to incorporate people with disabilities on campus. So that changed things too. People started getting an education. They started learning about, some people go in adaptive sports and recreation, and they started coming up with ideas. People, only a handful of us went into engineering, but at least some of us did, and we started looking at it from that perspective. Then there was a runners movement, so that kind of drove things. There was the International Year of People with Disabilities in 1981 from the UN. That brought attention. The VA created the National Veterans Wheelchair Games in 1981, created by Tom Brown and some others. Tom Brown himself was a wheelchair athlete, wheelchair track, field events and basketball. So I think it was kind of people started to come on their own, hey, we can do these things ourselves, we can take care of ourselves, and that caused innovation, created innovation. You know, I'm very proud that I was part of that, you know, myself, and like Marilyn Hamilton and Bobby Hall and Jim Martinson, Jeff Minnebreaker, and Brad Parks and others. And fun thing is we all know each other, right? Because we competed in sports against each other and we shared designs. And
do you think there was anything, was there anything?
Peter Axelson was another one, yeah. Peter Axelson was another person, and he's also a veteran. He's more on the winter sports side, like cross-country skiing and downhill skiing.
You had mentioned that, like, when people started to build their own chairs, there were some quality control issues, but that once, like, more computerized, like, creation of the parts came along, that mm-hmm. might have helped. Was there a role that like technology was playing in this like period of innovation, like new technologies that were becoming available that were allowing people to build better chairs?
Oh yeah, well, aluminum came down in price, and some of the Kevlar and stuff like that, stuff like the home built aircraft people started making that available. I used to buy a lot of chromoly and. Also carbon fiber and Kevlar from Aircraft Spruce and Specialty Company, which I learned about because a friend of mine's father was building a home-built aircraft, an ultralight aircraft, and so he gave me the catalog, and I thought, oh, look, there's all this cool stuff you can get for, I could use for wheelchair building in here. So that helped. And there was improvements in bicycle technology at the same time, and started to adopt that into make better wheelchairs. So wheelchairs still use like open bearings back at that time. And, you know, the bicycle industry was starting to go with the sealed bearings. And, you know, I used to actually, that's also the beauty of my parents having an automotive machine shop. The first bearings that I would use would be off of alternators or generators on cars when they went to like sealed bearings to last longer. Used to get the quick release pins on the chairs for the axles. They came from helicopters. I used to basically comb the surplus stores, the military surplus stores, and when they would show up, basically buy all the pins I could.
So was there any jealousy in the wheelchair racing community when you show up and you have a background in engineering and you were an athlete previously?
No, I didn't think, no. Well, there are other people. A lot of people were athletes before. I mean, right. Jim Knob was an Olympic pole vaulter. It wasn't us against each other so much. It was really us against the rest of the world.
Right.
Right? So most of those people they're friends now. They were friends then. They're still friends of mine now, right? And a lot of them are retired, but some are still innovators in other domains, some in other businesses. And Marilyn is still, now she's still like helping design therapeutic equipment. A lot of them, I think, liked the fact that I was an engineer. I would come up with something, design it, and then, you know, they'd copy it.
Yeah.
And other people came up with ideas too, and I would copy their ideas, incorporate them, and like I said, we were really trying to move the sport ahead, right?
You did mention wheelchair triathlons.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that? How does a wheelchair triathlon work?
Same it's just as a regular triathlon. You get in the pool and swim,
right?
Or the lake or river or whatever it is.
Uh-huh.
Excuse me, and then. You have to use a hand cycle for the bicycle part.
Mm-hmm.
It's now a Paralympic sport, which is pretty cool. I was the first one to do an Olympic level Olympic distance triathlon. use a racing chair for the quote running part.
Huh. And I know in the world of running, they have extreme triathlons and like extreme endurance races. Is that happening in wheelchair racing?
There's a few, yeah. I mean, some people have done the Ironman. Carlos Molina is one of them. When Carlos was a Navy SEAL injured in Panama, when I first met Carlos, kind of helped train him into wheelchair sports, and he's done the Ironman a few times. He's a great, great athlete. There's people that have done the Race Across America. It's actually been done in the 80s and 90s in their racing chair and now in hand cycles. Rick Hansen, actually Canadian, is an ambassador, and he's a very prominent Canadian celebrity. Actually, there's a bit of trivia, he was the Canadian Athlete of the Year, a title he shared that same year with Wayne Gretzky.
Nice.
And Rick actually pushed his racing chair around the world. First person to do that. That was in the late 1980s.
Interesting. So getting back to your career, in 1989 you began work at Cal State Sacramento.
Correct.
You were hired as an assistant professor in the department of, let's see, electrical and electronic engineering and biomedical engineering.
Correct.
At the same time, you were an assistant professor in the Assistive Device Center.
Yep.
You were hired to do both at the same time.
Yeah.
What was the Assistive Device Center? Was that already existing when you...
That was already existing. That's created by a professor named Al Cook.
What kind of work were they doing?
They provided technology, assistive technology to people with disabilities. So it was a clinic.
Okay, so it wasn't a lab. Was it creating new technologies?
Yeah, well, at that time you had no choice.
Right.
So all the clinics at that time made technologies as well as delivered them. So that's actually kind of how the field of rehabilitation engineering started. And it really started in the 60s, sort of started getting formalized in the 1980s. But yeah, you had to... to this day, actually, we still fabricate things for certain clients. There's always some orphan products or somebody who's got an unmet need with existing commercial products. But at that time, that was pretty common. We'd literally be making cushions and backrests and inserts and specialty seating systems and alternative switch controls and writing custom software.
And was your role when you began at Cal State Sacramento, was that teaching or was that research? Was it both?
Everybody at Cal State Sacramento teaches. It's primarily a teaching school.
Gotcha.
But I did research there as well.
What were you teaching?
I taught rehabilitation engineering. I taught some robotics. I taught some control systems. And I taught some medical instrumentation.
Gotcha. And then in 1990, they opened up the Human Engineering Laboratory.
I created that.
You created that, okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I had started to expand my research, and so I asked the department chair and the dean for some space and to create the Human Engineering Laboratory. Started to attract more students there.
Mm-hmm. And that's kind of an offshoot of your work in the Assistive Device Center, was it?
This was
to
be more focused on research.
Okay.
The ATC didn't really do research per se. It did do new devices for individuals and would publish case studies. But its focus was on clinical service delivery.
Gotcha. And then in 1992, you got tenure
at
Cal State. And then in 1994, you made the transition. You became a visiting professor first here at Pitt.
I did, yeah. I gave up a tenured stream position to come to Pitt to be a visiting professor.
Gotcha. Can you talk about that? Was that a hard decision to make, or was that?
It was. But I wanted to take my chances to be at a major research university. Mm-hmm. They were starting this new department of rehab, science and technology, plus a bioengineering department at Pitt. Mm-hmm. And... I just see my postdoc advisor, Charlie Robinson, I've been appointed the first chair here. And he talked to me about coming out, what the opportunity would be. It took me about a year to kind of decide back and forth, but we decided to make the jump.
Okay.
Like we talked about earlier, I'd kind of learned the lesson that a lot of major universities hire people outside the tenure stream, and if you do well, you have a chance to move in the tenure stream. So I took my chances.
And so you came to Pitt to found this lab?
Yep, to found Hurl, yeah.
Gotcha. So they said come and make a lab.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Work with the VA. And
that's an interesting partnership. So how did the VA become involved?
The VA became involved from the very beginning. I did my postdoc in the VA at Heinz VA in Chicago with Charlie and John Trimble. And they had a rehabilitation research and development center, which Hurl now is from the VA. And so I had VA funding from Sacramento. And the VA here in Pittsburgh did not have a lot of rehab rehab research and had, besides Charlie, no rehab engineering research. And they wanted to, and it makes sense. The VA has a long history of strong rehab engineering research dating back to World War II. And so in order for the university to build its research, to partner with the VA made sense. And we originally partnered with the Highland Drive VA, which no longer exists. But it was a neuropsychiatric VA and rehab center.
Okay.
So it had a lot, it was a kind of a nice place to get started.
So did they give you free rein when you came here and said, you have the vision, you set up the lab how you want it?
I don't know about free rein.
Right.
They gave me $25,000 and in a bathroom and a locker room to start my lab in. the original Hurl was in our my wife stayed in California to finish her degree for the first 6 months. So the original Hurl lab was in our basement and dining room. Once the VA found a bathroom and a locker room to give us a space. We moved into the bathroom and the locker room. My original office was literally the towel cage.
Nice.
And so, some rather austere start. I guess if that you could call that free reign.
Did they give you a promise of funding for a certain amount of time? Or they?
Nope. $25,000 in a bathroom and a locker room.
And that was it?
That was it. Sink or swim.
Gotcha. So how'd that go? Obviously, it worked out.
I could swim.
Yeah.
I was able to bring a couple of grants with me from California, and we were able to get some success pretty quickly on with getting grants.
Gotcha. And I was going to ask about funding, how this lab works and how the history of the funding has changed over time, if it has.
It's changed tremendously. Well, early on, we were lucky. I found Mike Boninger, who was coming here as a postdoc, and we were able to get him supported on a NIDER postdoctoral fellowship grant. He became the medical director, and then he was able to get an NIH KO8 award, Early Faculty Development Award. And that really helped a lot. Between him and I, we wrote grants, and for a while we were very successful. We kept getting them. Mm-hmm. Now, so that's what we lived off of, basically. He had to provide some clinical services. He's an MD. I had to do some teaching and get my grants. The big change for us was in 1999, we were able to land a VA Rehabilitation Research and Development Center and a NIDER Spinal Cord Injury Model Systems grant. So that's what really changed things. The other thing that really helped us out is Paralyzed Veterans of America has always helped me in Sacramento. They would help out with small amounts of funding. When I moved from Sacramento to Pittsburgh, they also continue to contribute to funding, and they do to this day. That helped us quite a bit. And eventually they coordinate with some other foundations like the Pfizer Foundation, which is not Pfizer, the drug company, but Pfizer, F-I-S-A. And then we got engaged in wheelchair testing in the 1980s from Sacramento, and I had personally paid for some of that equipment, so I brought it with me. That got us early on in wheelchair testing, exposed us to some of the companies, and they sponsored some of our development work and some of our students as well, and got engaged with Dean Kamen and Johnson & Johnson on the Segway and the iBot. That helped us to sort of build up some corporate-sponsored research and development. That allowed us to get more space, hire more people, build a bigger team, go after more grants, bigger grants, and kind of led us to where we are now. How we're still funded today is, fortunately, we have a couple of endowments. So some people like the PVA and Pfizer Foundation and others have been generous enough to help contribute towards endowments. We have some donors that help support from our program. We work with the university to set up like an individual donor campaign to support HURL and some of its individual programs. We still rely heavily on grants and contracts. We're pretty much a soft money organization. I'd love to find an endowment spot, a naming sponsor or something like that, right? That could give us some long-term security. It's a tough life, living in 3 and 5 year segments. Which is the length of typical grants. At least having some small endowments and some gifts helps smooth out the peaks and the valleys to start some new ideas and fund some seed projects and to help people when they're struggling a little bit to bridge them between grants. So. We've grown to basically a bathroom and a locker room to about 30,000 square feet and on and about 70 people to 70 to 100. In the summer, we balloon up to about 100 when we bring in the student interns. Mm. In the core, we've stayed the same. Our mission vision is pretty much, it's been tweaked a little bit, but basically what it was. We've always engaged students. It's always been about teaching students in research and undergraduates, graduate students, and postdocs in research, creating new technologies that, creating and evaluating new technologies to change the lives for people with disability for the better, with a strong focus on the veterans population.
When you first started the lab, you were very well. Sacramento, in your own personal experience, you're very involved in wheelchair technology. Was that the focus in the beginning of starting the lab, or was it?
Yeah, the beginning was manual wheelchair technology. Mm-hmm. There was still a tremendous need for advancement. We've kind of moved, we still do a little bit of that, especially in the fitting and the ergonomics and transfers. There's, you know, we've disseminated a lot of that information. It's, I think, the clinicians, consumers understand it fairly well. You know, could do a little bit better on the uptake of the knowledge. All of healthcare kind of has that problem. We've driven, you know, the need has moved more towards power chairs, robotics. Smartphones are 10 years old now, so they offered an entire different opportunity for cognitive aids and using AI to improve adoption or get people to change their habits to be more healthy. So you've got to keep advancing the science and evolve to solve the next problems.
Mm-hmm. So what's your day-to-day, has it changed since the time that this lab has started? Because I know you've written 300 journal articles, several books, you have 20 patents.
Right.
You've been busy.
I've been busy. I'm still busy. That's not going to change.
Do you get to spend time in the lab?
I do. I don't know if I would do this anymore if I couldn't spend time in the lab. There's two kind of absolutes for me, and actually I guess three. If we're not having fun making a real positive difference, I don't want to do it. Mm-hmm. I want to be interacting with my colleagues, my students, and my staff every day if possible, but at least several days per week, mm-hmm. and so be directly engaged in the projects. I want to spend some time in the lab every day that I'm in Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. So those are kind of the things that I strive for. So I usually start my day in the lab. I found that that's the easiest way to make sure I get time in the lab. If I go to the lab first and then come to the office, then I'll get time in the lab. If I come to the office, there's always somebody or some email or something waiting for me to take care of. So. I have a bad habit. I drink one Coke a day, and I keep them in the lab so that and I go down there and it gives me another hour or so to, depending on what my schedule allows, to go down and work in the lab and. Hopefully solve problems, if not kibitz, and see what's going on.
Could you talk about some of the major successes that you guys have had at Hurl? What you're most proud of? What products you've created?
Well, I mean, the thing I'm most proud of is that we actually have Hurl. It's still here 23 years later, right? And hopefully we'll be here will be my legacy. The second most proudest thing is all the people that we've trained, the undergrad, the research experience for undergrad students, the postdocs, the doctoral students, graduate students that have gone out and have taken our message and our knowledge and built upon it and really helped build this field. And so, you know, those are really the lasting accomplishments. Mm-hmm. All the devices will eventually become obsolete at some time, but hopefully, we've trained people that are creating new devices. Like David Allgood, who's the vice president for Permobil, and just recently, like Jessica Berkman, who's now working for Next Health, and kind of. Just started her first job. She has a severe disability with cerebral palsy. So, you know, those are the great things. The devices. That's like asking to pick your favorite child, right? So, and then they're all important in some ways. So, mm-hmm. The natural fit hand rim and the surge hand rim have really. Had a tremendous impact on reducing the incidence of rotator cuff injuries and carpal tunnel syndrome, mm-hmm. and provided years of healthy mobility for people. So you've got to be very proud. You know, we're very proud of that accomplishment. The smart wheel, which I started as a graduate student, has changed how we prescribe manual wheelchairs and fitted and driven the whole field of wheelchair propulsion ergonomics. And mm-hmm. used widely throughout the world, we worked on the Pawpaw with Yamaha, the pusher immaculate power assist wheelchair, created an entirely new class of wheelchairs, and they're out there, and that's even in the kind of the pre-hurl of the modern racing chair has its roots in the work that I did. It still has a crown compensator very similar to what I designed. It has the push rims very similar to what I used. It has fenders that I invented. It has a side carriage that I invented. It's the three-wheeler. I was one of the people to pioneer that. So, that every time somebody's out there racing, it's using that technology still. And hand cycles, right? I was one of the first one to create hand cycles for racing, and now it's a whole sport in the Paralympics, and see it in marathons, and I participate myself. So, our virtual seating coach could make tremendous impact on reducing pressure ulcers, lymphedema, and other issues with the power wheelchair users. Our air chair just came on the market. The first units rolled off in water parks in Texas, and I'm getting emails and links on Facebook of kids for the first time being able to drive through a pond, through a pool of water, or spraying each other with hoses, fighting on two pirate ships at Morgan's Inspiration Island. So it's kind of hard. To me, the most gratifying thing is not the technologies we develop, but the impact they've had on people's lives. Mm-hmm. And to me, the most fun thing is when I see those. Two things, actually. One of them is when people tell me how wonderful this or that is, without knowing that I'm one of the inventors or Hurl is one of the inventors. And you meet them in an airport or something like that, or at a hotel, and they say, "Oh, hey, man, you use the surge hand rims too. I love those. Those things are really cool. You can't believe how they've changed my life. I don't have shoulder pain anymore." How about you? Does it help you too?
And do you tell them eventually?
Eventually, yeah. You let them talk for a while and say, "Oh, thank you." I usually say, "Thanks for contributing to my retirement." And they're like, "What do you mean?" I say, "I'm one of the inventors. I get a little bit of royalties off of that. It came out of Hurl." And then they're like, "Well, who are you?" I say, "I'm Rory Cooper." "Oh, you're Dr. Cooper. I read about you on the web." So that's kind of fun. Or just now on social media, right? Where you go, when you can read somebody on somebody's website, "Oh, this changed my child's life," or "This is, this is awesome." That's really what it's about, right? Making a positive difference in people's lives.
You and your lab are at the forefront of wheelchair technology, I would say. What does the future of the wheelchair look like?
Robotics. It's going to get. They're going to wear. We're going to self drive. If you look at self driving cars, that's kind of looks. I think the future of wheelchairs to some extent. Mm. Giving more people more autonomy. It's sort of the self-driving car, and then on the other side, better human-machine interfaces. Mm-hmm. So if you look about it, we've always been about that, about sort of advanced technology and human-machine interfaces. Even with manual chairs, it was the physical interface. We still do some of that with power chairs. And on power sources, I think, is the other one. You know, looking at, you can see cars moving from internal combustion gasoline engines, and you saw, you know, natural gas and propane, and then electric vehicles, like hybrid vehicles. Now fuel cells are starting to come in. You know, the new chair, the air powered, right, is moving away from standard lead acid batteries. Early on, when we worked with Yamaha, we worked on nickel cadmium batteries and the nickel metal hydride batteries. With the iBot, we did nickel cadmium, nickel metal hydride, then lithium ion, lithium polymer. So we've kind of been pushing those for quite some time, but there's still a lot more to be done in alternative power sources as well. And then the service delivery models. We've got people like Brad DiCiano, and Mike Boninger, and my wife Rosie Cooper, Mark Schmaler, that are working on how do you better get research into practice? Mm-hmm. How do you make that happen faster? How do we so we speed up the adoption rate? And we got people like John Perlman who are trying to bring these advances both in service delivery and in technology to low income countries. So it's not just the people in the United States, Europe, and mm-hmm. some parts of Asia, specifically Japan and Korea, that benefit to that, this information and technology gets disseminated worldwide. So the impact is now we're not local, our impact's global.
Right.
And our technologies we work on in wheelchairs and robotics and cognitive aids and actually telerehabilitation in order to improve service delivery.
So, for you, what does the future of Hurdle look like? What's next?
Like I said, with the technology areas, more diversity. We've always, I think, been on the forefront of including people with disabilities and women in Hurdle, and I want to grow that. I'd like to make that actually be a model for others as well. So, like John has been doing to disseminate across the world the technologies and the service delivery, and now Mark Schmaler and Rosie and Brad have disseminated our technologies and across the United States. I think we need to get, we can influence STEM education and get greater opportunities for people with disabilities, including our veterans with disabilities. We've, you know, grown more into the veterans space and like veterans education, mm-hmm. veterans transition assistance, for veterans with disabilities, because of the opportunities in STEM. I think that's something we'll continue to grow in Hurdle. I'd like to see Hurdle, like I said earlier, find a naming opportunity and so that we have some long-term stability. And also, I think we want to continue to improve our technology transfer. We're generating more patents now. We're working more closely with the technology transfer in the VA, the Innovation Center in the VA, and the Innovation Institute of the University, to train innovators so they could go out and start new businesses, because there's, I think, a lot of opportunity there, and to accelerate the pace of research and development into both clinical practice and into products that get in people's hands. So, I invented the smart wheel in 1986. It actually didn't come to market till 2002.
Wow.
If you look in the air chair, we started 3 years ago, even just investigating the motors and the feasibility, mm-hmm. and it's on the market now. We didn't even start making the first power chair prototype. We had a scooter prototype. We started making a power chair prototype. Designing the power chair prototype in June of 2016. It was on the market by June of 17. Not that we could do that with everything. You need kind of a balance of things that take longer term and things that shorter term, but if it can be done shorter term, I'd like to have the resources to do that. The other thing is there's still a tremendous, technology has tremendous potential, and there's tremendous need for people with disabilities to benefit from that technology.
Mm-hmm. And I know you work a lot with the veteran community, obviously. Can mm-hmm. you talk about that, those interactions, and also what groups specifically that you're working with?
Paralyzed Veterans of America has been a supporter forever, mm-hmm. but we're we have great relationships with many of the veteran service organizations, Disabled American Veterans, Disabled Veterans National Foundation, the Wounded Warrior Project, mm-hmm. American Legion, VFW. They all support what we're doing, either through dissemination of information, some cases financially, mm-hmm. some participating in our research, generating research ideas. We're also changing our research to be more consumer-driven, the ideas coming from the consumer, so we're doing a big voice of the consumer, voice of the provider study. We've always kind of done that in a less formal way because of our clinic at the Center for Assistive Technology and our relationships with these organizations, but now trying to formalize that data gathering, which is more feasible now with the social media mechanisms for gathering opinions and perspectives and needs. And then locally, we're very engaged with Mission Continues and Team Red, White, and Blue, and the Veterans Leadership Program, and Steel City Veterans. So that helps. We're engaged with the VA itself, Office of Research and Development, the Technology Transfer Innovation, mm-hmm. The clinical side too. With the DOD, we partnered with the Center for Rehabilitation Science Research at the Uniformed Services University, the EACE, which is the Extremity and Amputation Center of Excellence, which is a joint VA-DOD center out of San Antonio. We've partnered with Walter Reed's Military Advanced Training Center, or MATSE, and also the center, the NICA, the National Intrepid Center of Excellence, and the Wounded Warrior Regiment from the Marine Corps and the Army Warrior Transition Command. Hmm. So we plan to continue to do those and support things like the Veterans Wheelchair Games and the Warrior Games. And the other thing that's, I think, the future for us is building our international collaborations. So we work a little bit with the University of Alberta in Edmonton and Martin Ferguson Pell and his group. And we've had a long relationship with Lee Kirby up in Dalhousie University and Urs Schneider at Stuttgart and the Fraunhofer Institute and Jong Bae Kim at Yonsei University and Sachio Nabe at Nagano University. So to continue and build on those collaborations and others, so we know what's going on globally and get things out globally faster, and also pick up on global advances and increase our subject pool too.
HURL has long been a magnet for students with disabilities, for people training. You work with undergrads as well
as
graduate students. Was that a natural progression, or was that one of your goals when you started?
That was one of my goals. I wanted a lab where one you could do soup to nuts, where you could come up with an idea, develop it, create it, mm-hmm. Test it, and then try it in the clinic and then disseminate it broadly, and all the way from small scale focus groups to multi-site clinical mm-hmm. trials. But the other part is create an inclusive workplace. Mm-hmm. It's kind of back to the disability advocacy days of, sort of nothing about us without us. There was no way that we were going to create HURL without having it, having people with disabilities have a substantial role mm-hmm. in HURL at all levels.
Any questions?
Yeah. So I wanted to ask about what it was like leaving California behind and moving to Pittsburgh? I know when you had a job offer at one point in Illinois, your wife said, I'm not shoveling snow anywhere outside of Germany. So how did that transition go?
Well, the early transition was not easy. We arrived to 27 inches of snow in Pittsburgh, and we're snowed in for a few days. And fortunately, we have some great neighbors that helped us out. And my wife still doesn't have to shovel snow. We've had friends and neighbors be able to help us with that over the years. But she had to leave her family in Germany. We had to leave I left my family in California. That was difficult. The four seasons were a bit difficult. On the other hand, the veterans community and the disability community have been very welcoming of both of us, and we're now deeply rooted in the Pittsburgh community and have some wonderful relationships. The other part that is a challenge then and actually exists to be a challenge is California is much more progressive on inclusiveness about people with disabilities and just people in a more inclusive culture. Pittsburgh's a friendly Midwestern city, or at least perceives itself to be a Midwestern city. I realize from Philadelphia it's considered a primitive backwater. The culture's changing, and I think bringing companies like Google, and as the University of Pittsburgh grows, and Carnegie Mellon's very diverse, that the culture will change. The culture has been changing for the positive to be more inclusive, at all levels. But it's still different.
In terms of both the city and the university, how was that in terms of accessibility, and sort of how has that changed over time?
Well, Pittsburgh is geographically challenged for accessibility, right? So it's an older city and there's lots of hills, and so that makes it difficult. And you can put curb cuts in, but if it's on a really steep hill, that's still not much of help. But the city at least is taking that seriously and doing assessment for sidewalks and working on public transportation. Employment is kind of the big barrier. There's physical barriers to employment, and there's the biggest barrier actually to employment for people with disabilities, and from my perspective, is the social barrier, getting people to understand, to welcome people with disabilities in the workplace, and to be understanding of their needs, going beyond accommodation and the legal aspects. I see Chancellor Gallagher starting to make those changes at the University of Pittsburgh. But I think that for a long time, it was more a legal obligation rather than a moral imperative.
Mm-hmm. When you first came here, you said you were sort of in a bathroom in a locker room. Did you have colleagues that you were, were you part of a community at the university when you got here? Or were you sort of on your own?
I had Mike Boninger, and then Rick Robertson came out for a while from California, and then he went back and started his own business. I felt like in some ways I had to build my own community. There were very few faculty with disabilities on campus. There were not really many people working in this, and I was a bit isolated from my colleagues in the department. Originally they were in Forbes Tower on campus, and then they moved out to U Park, which is the university's, Pittsburgh's Applied Research Center, about 10 miles from here. That was challenging. That made it particularly hard when you think about, we left our family, we didn't have that support, and then we had to, the work. I was isolated. I will say that the people in the VA were wonderful, and we built a community around the VA. And they always have been very, very supportive of what I do.
How was it finding accessible housing in Pittsburgh?
Almost impossible. We live about 18 miles outside the city in a beautiful ranch house. We had to do a lot of modifications to make it accessible, and now it's fully accessible. That was a bit of a challenge, too, because you had to find contractors and things like that. Literally, we had to stay in a hotel for a while our house was made accessible. So that's accessible, affordable housing, not only for low-income people with disabilities, but moderate, all income levels in Pittsburgh is a challenge, and modest income people too. That's something the area still needs to work on. The university also just needs to work on providing more housing for students with disabilities, especially like graduate students and postdocs, so they could come here and have a place to live until they find a place, especially since there is such a shortage of accessible housing.
The university.
And when I first came here, I was almost impossible to find a dentist, for example, right?
What is the challenge with finding?
They just weren't accessible. They were upstairs, or the dental exam rooms were too small to get a wheelchair in, or they had a dental chair that you couldn't transfer into. Mm-hmm. All of those. I mean, actually, even a lot of the doctors' clinics. Fortunately, I'm eligible for the VA, and the VA has sort of national standards, but outside the VA, in the private sector hospitals, and even UPMC at the time. It really wasn't until the late 1990s, it was in the early 2000s that UPMC started looking at how do you become more accessible. And there's still, as an employee, there's a lot of the businesses, including the University of Pittsburgh, where they can make improvements in accommodations.
Mm-hmm. Are the buses in Pittsburgh accessible?
The buses are pretty good. And the kneeling buses have been a huge breakthrough for accessibility. The problem is that there's still not as much, ideally every bus would be fully accessible, and every driver would be trained and accommodating. So physically we're getting better there. There's still another thing, and it's about attitudes, right? It takes a little longer for a person in a power chair to get on the bus, and the bus driver feels anxious, the other passengers, and you have to get to the point where people just accept that that's the way it is, right? And we should just relax a little bit. The extra 30 seconds isn't going to kill anybody.
Yeah. I think that's it.
Do you have anything you want to add that we didn't cover that you would like to
talk about? Well, I think that we should talk about, since Pittsburgh, we have all the self-driving cars and stuff here, and I think that has a lot of potential for people with disabilities and older adults, but it also has a lot of potential, if we're not careful, to leave them behind. And we had that problem with the smartphones when they first came out. I mean, they're wonderful, like people who are deaf can text, and that's texting is even probably more ubiquitous than calling on the phone, and so that was a tremendous breakthrough, but then, everybody got rid of keyboards and wanted touch screens, and they made this device that everybody was using largely inaccessible to people who are visually impaired. Now, voice navigation has got to the point where it's pretty good and it's been more welcoming, but you got to be careful that these technologies, as they are developed, are also inclusive. I think self-driving cars have a tremendous potential if you can't drive at all, and you can have a self-driving car, but you got to be able to find the car. The car's got to find you. You got to be able to get in it. You got to get your stuff in it. You got to be able to get out of it. I think that's, those sort of, which we have to be aware of as well.
Any other questions? Thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure. Thank you. Mm-hmm.